You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
My name is Arye Nair. I'm the president of the Open Society Institute, and my role here this evening is simply to welcome you to this discussion of the book about Herb Sturz, A Kind of Genius. I do want to say that the Open Society Institute has been privileged to be the home for Herb Sturz in using his genius to address a variety of issues over the past dozen years or so. And we have institutionally benefited greatly from the quite amazing array of efforts that Herb has engaged in during that period. I also had in mind saying that I was particularly well qualified to welcome you here this evening because I thought I was the person here who had known Herb longest. We go back to the 1960s, and then I discovered that Victor Navasky, who is here, went to camp with with Herb. So Victor is the champion. At any rate, the discussion this evening is going to be moderated by Chris Stone. Chris is a professor of the practice of criminal justice at the Kennedy School at Harvard. He is a successor of Herb as the executive director of the Vera Institute, and Chris also serves on two boards of the Open Society Institute. He serves as a member of the board of the Open Society Justice Institute, and he also serves as a member of the board of a special initiative which funds programs dealing with pretrial detention, an issue that Herb made a significant issue in the United States and internationally, and funds programs dealing with legal aid. So I'm happy to turn this over to Chris.
Thank you, Arye, and it is it's a huge pleasure to be here with Herb and Sam and all of you. I'm going to just make a couple of opening remarks about Herb and Sam's book, and then I'm going to invite Sam to speak briefly. Herb will say a few words, and then we'll get into a discussion, and we will end somewhere before 7:45, and people a chance to get some books if you haven't gotten them yet. It's a real privilege to be here with all of you, particularly with Arye and with Sam and all of those who are quoted in this remarkable book, to give credit really to a man who spent a huge amount of his life giving credit to others. I've got a few mixed feelings about the publication of this book, and I thought I would just share that mixture of feelings. I am delighted that a wide readership is going to come to know Herb Sturz's extraordinary story, his life and his work. It's going to be really handy for me to have a single volume that I can give to students and colleagues who want to learn about the craft, learn lessons about social innovation, a craft and a set of skills that we need desperately more of in this society, and which Herb turned into an art form. He elevated the practice of social innovation to an art form I'm not sure anybody has matched. And Sam captures that, I think, remarkably well in this book. Let me just give you three of my favorite skill sets that are on display in this book. One of them is Herb's pursuit of facts. And you'd think that was pretty basic, you know, sort of go after facts before you plan something. But I remember when Ellen Sweet and I were doing an oral history Vera early in my time at Vera in the mid 1990s. Herb told a story. He told a story about getting facts that stayed with me, has stayed with me ever since in every project I've done. He said, you know, you go in, you can walk into a police station, and you can ask the precinct commander. This is before Comstat. The so how many arrests were there last week? And the problem is, he'll give you an answer. It won't have anything to do with how many arrests there were last week, but he thinks he knows the answer, or she thinks she knows the answer, and she'll tell you. And to understand that people don't actually know what they think they know, and so you have to find out for yourself. You've got to ask. You've got to be there yourself. That kind of pursuit of facts runs all the way through this book and is a hugely important lesson. Second one is what Sam calls double social utility, but at least in my experience, this is the art of multiple social utility. Double is fine as a minimum, but actually when you look at Herb's projects, you can sort of have a little game of trying to figure out just how many multiples there are in each of these projects, 3, 4, 5 problems solved at once. Herb's example teaches reformers that life is just too short to solve problems one at a time. And so you have to design innovations that solve a whole set of simultaneous equations at once, where the answer solves multiple problems. And Herb's life and work is a lesson in how to do that. The third that Sam hits over and over again in the book is about persistence. Sam quotes Michael Weinstein, who's here, describing Herb as the most persistent person I know. And I remember a story Herb told me when I started at Vera about persistence and the importance of persistence as the secret of Vera's early success. He said, you know, he proposed something on a Monday and half the room would be against it. And he'd come back on Tuesday and on Wednesday and on Thursday. And by Friday, the critics had sort of moved on, but he'd still be there. And by then, he could get it done. But while I delight in the prospect of a new generation of social innovators able to draw lessons from this master's work, I actually regret that to do that, Herb has had to step into the limelight. There's a danger, I think, that in focusing our attention on Herb and on his genius, that the simplicity and the accessibility of his method will actually be obscured. Perhaps you wince, as I do, as you read this book or hear other conversations, when you hear Herb described as a social entrepreneur, a term that has come to convey, along with a talent for innovation, a self-aggrandizement that Herb never indulged. We can admire the marquee social entrepreneurs like Wendy Kopp and Muhammad Yunus, but Herb belongs, in my view, to a different category, and his method deserves a different label. So let me just wrap this up by saying I want to sort of point to three ways in which I think Herb distinguishes himself from those social entrepreneurs, really giving us a different kind of a role and lesson. The first, let me just say, is about the way Herb engages with government. It's easy to see Herb's work and life and see, well, you know, he and several people in the book talk about this. He understood you couldn't scale things up without government. He needed government to fund things. But Herb didn't just merely use government to fund and scale his innovations. Herb understood that people in government really cared about the same things that he did. And he had a gift, not just about using government to make his projects big, but to help people in government realize their own best ambitions, their ambitions to make the world a little more just. The second thing Herb does, I think just extraordinarily, is he has learned over the years and taught a lot of us about trading control for scale. Herb kept learning throughout his life, and this is there in the book. And two of his last projects that are described in the book, Nurture, the South African project on developing housing, and TASC, the after-school corporation, both of them born right here, illustrate, I think, how Herb learned to really master scale. Yes, these were partnerships with government, but so were Herb's earlier projects. Brilliant projects, but they didn't, in my view, achieve the scale that these later two did. And Herb found, I think, that real scale required that he give up a little of that control that's so alluring and important to nurture young projects. But you have to give that control up even more than you might, and even more than than may have happened in some of the early ventures. Gary LaMarche is quoted by Sam in the book talking about this in TASC, talks about how TASC really came into its own and really made a huge difference to the whole field of aftercare, after-school work in a way that I think all of us can learn from. But the third way, I think, in which Herb outpaces the social entrepreneurs is about keeping quiet. Herb's low profile is not, in my observation, merely a tactic. And it's not just about giving credit to others. At least in my experience, Herb is a fundamentally quiet man. And perhaps that's what a commitment to true justice requires. Enlarging justice is the social construction project that never ends, where the scaffolding can never be taken down. The result is always imperfect. Every boast is oversimplified. Every supposed success is premature. Enlarging justice is a project where the means are all you'll really ever know, and therefore where the means you use are how you will be judged. Justice, in short, is an ambition that requires a quiet genius and a quiet method. And for that, I think we owe the deepest of debts to Herb Sturz. Sam, do you want to start by just giving us a flavor of...
I will start by giving you a little flavor. I'm sorry there are no camp stories in this book. We'll have to hear from Victor afterward, though. I will vouch for the fact, as Chris says, that Herb is a quiet man, and that made extracting some of these stories all the more difficult. Quiet and modest, and that, of course, is what his strength is all about, as Arye and Chris have said. I cover urban affairs at the New York Times and had covered her peripherally over the years in various of his incarnations, at Vera a little bit, certainly as deputy mayor and head of the planning commission in the Koch administration, was a colleague, I think, ever so briefly when he was on the editorial board at the Times, and stayed in touch when he was at OSI. And my mandate is to sort of cover change and power, particularly in the city, but also on a nationwide basis, why things happen and why they don't happen. And what better instrument for explaining power than looking at Herb and making things work in big ways and small. I was struck by what distinguishes Herb. As Chris said, there are things that make him unique as a social innovator, social entrepreneur, social engineer, whatever you want to call it. Peter Goldmark called him the Michael Jordan of social engineering, so versatile, so energetic. The things that struck me are, among others, the length of time that he's been doing this. He's been doing it for 50 years or so, much longer than the term social entrepreneur has been popularized. And we were talking very, very late in the book, something that that he realized and I considered important. I'm not sure how many of you have read the book, and you won't be tested on it, I promise. But Herb talks about a letter that he wrote to John Steinbeck while he was going to Columbia Teachers College. A professor had given him back a paper he wrote, and the only criticism of the paper was that the margins weren't right. And Herb thought that what he had to say, frankly, was much more profound than all of that. And he wrote Steinbeck a letter explaining what his theory was. And Steinbeck wrote him back, and he said, and Herb said, this was the first time that someone had really taken him seriously. And it set him off on a path toward social justice, toward many of the themes that Steinbeck wrote about in The Grapes of Wrath. And interestingly enough, as I say, we only realized toward the very end that Tom Joad in The Grapes of Wrath, I'm not sure how many of you remember, but Tom Joad was the perfect example of prisoner reentry and the problems of prisoner reentry long before that term was ever coined, and something that Herb, as soon as he could, both at Boys Life magazine and then certainly at Vera, sunk his teeth into very deeply. So it's the length of time he's been doing this. It is the breadth of the projects he has taken into his portfolio, from bail, from homelessness, from alcoholism, from urban renewal, housing, affordable housing, now foreclosures, just a scope that is absolutely enormous. You can look at, as what Chris said, some of the marquee names in social entrepreneurship, and I wouldn't begrudge them their marquee status, but most of them have dealt with one subject area and dealt with it very, very well. Herb has dealt with dozens, if you will, of areas and dealt with them very well. And that's another thing that distinguishes him. As Chris said, a third thing in my mind is his recognition that government is not an adversary. Why should we expect government to do certain things on its own? It can't possibly, and the private sector can use its leverage, its money, to do that. And when you look at the various incarnations that Herb has used that leverage, initially through Vera, one could argue as sort of a supplicant for money from anybody who would give it, starting with Louis Schweitzer. Then as an insider within the government itself, affecting all sorts of policy in criminal justice, then in city planning, including Times Square renewal, for which he is much more responsible than a lot of the public officials, elected officials who have claimed credit for that. The whole notion you can do more, you can leverage that power in so many other ways through the government, and then through his role as a benefactor later at OSI, which enabled him to get involved in South African affordable housing and spill over that program to New York City. Let me just end quickly, because I'd rather leave more time for your questions and Chris's. Herb and I were both a little nervous about the title of this book. First of all, kind of genius, I wanted to make sure nobody mistook it for an autobiography. But secondly, Herb, with all his modesty, was reluctant to be defined as even a kind of genius, much less a genius. But one of the things I did in researching the book was look up some definitions of genius, and two came to mind that I think are worth repeating here, to which Herb fits rather perfectly. Sylvia Nasser, formerly the New York Times, wrote her book A Beautiful Mind about John Forbes Nash. The comparison with John Forbes Nash ends there, but she she describes genius as a profound dislike for merely absorbing knowledge and a strong compulsion to learn by doing. That has been Herb Sturz's mantra, learn by doing. And James Joyce said, a genius makes no mistakes. Errors to a genius are the portals of discovery. And it reminds me of something that Jay Kriegel, his friend, said about Herb not long ago, that Herb Sturz is not afraid to fail. And I think that, again, puts him in a special category in the world of social innovation and social entrepreneurship.
Well, thank you. And it is embarrassing after all of this.
That's what we're here for.
That's what we're here for, to embarrass me. Let me first say on giving me some kind of credit on the scale question with Nurture and with Task. I think I believe the major, my major accomplishment in relationship to Nurture was helping to find Cedric De Beer, who turned out to be the executive director. When we first met, he was doing urbanization. He was not a housing person.
Does everyone know what NERCHA is? I'm sure here.
I think pretty much everyone here does know. It's
a hometown
crowd. The great housing program that really was developed by George Soros, REA, Philip Von Zale, Slabbert. And then REA and I met again after many years, I went over there with Fred Harris and saw the usual sort of people that were crucial. But there was this Cedric De Beer, and I felt this is the person that we really had to engage. And I did talk him into becoming the deputy director. And then a week before the project started, the director decided, Keshley Shabani, that he wanted to keep his own job. So we went up and said to Cedric, you got to take it, you got to do it. And this was right before Mandela came into power, and it was surely counterintuitive to have a white person head up this housing at the time. But the the black South Africans on the board all felt we just this is the right person too, and it worked, and he's still there, and he deserves enormous. On task, Arye, Gara, and I, was it quite involved in putting the concept together, but we went to scale because it wasn't any insight on my part. George Soros, put it to scale. But we also did know that to break through with the Board of Education, they had had their fill of boutique experiments, and that's how they put it, and they just, you just wouldn't have gotten their attention, and it could never have happened in that experiment. Other things still are, I do believe, have to begin generally small, and you build, and you play with it, and you keep changing it, and what you start with never ends up to what it is, because you now have more information, more facts, and in the process, that is what happens, and I think that's the element of bringing change about. And it's been a kind of a fun journey, and it's been fun, Sam, working with you and getting to know you in this process. And I felt really lucky to be associated with OSI. I guess it began in 94, and I've been here when I went over to Johannesburg just before the elections, and then I've been here a little over 11 years full-time, and they've been very, very rich and wonderful. And you talk about failure. Of course, I've had my failures. I'll be real quick. But one was trying to sell Rikers Island to the state, and Whitey Horn knows about this. And we came really close. I think the idea, of course, was Rikers should be sentenced population, not a pretrial detention. And we should build with money we would get detention facilities near the courthouses in the boroughs. And there's a lot of logic to it. But the community and others, maybe Marty in the question, and we'll fill in. But we got $200 million was appropriated by the state. That didn't happen. And
we noticed.
I tried to move south the police academy from 23rd Street to the South Bronx when South Bronx was burning, and thinking this would be economic development, it would be crime control. Never happened. Another failure. And so I've had, as I tried to do a heroin experiment for people who failed every other attempt at rehabilitation or getting off drugs. That didn't quite happen. I understand it went right to the desk of then President Nixon, and where somehow the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs was sort of moving along, thinking they had it to do it. And we're going back to something now. I tried to do something with the unsafe buildings with Ed Koch, and thinking that there are individual buildings in these tough parts of Brooklyn and South Bronx, and the best thing we'd do, we'd tear it down. I tried to get before Iraq, the National Guard to do the work at no cost. And Koch said he loved this idea, and I ended up meeting with the Secretary of the Army, Cliff Alexander, who said, "Good idea. We can't just do it." And later, a couple of years, I got to know him well. We were on a board together, and he said it was one of his mistakes, that it didn't help out much. But, of course, life has changed. And so I've had those and a couple more that I can think of, but I think that's enough. But it's the process of doing stuff is the process of learning, and learning is fun. And it's always a little nerve-wracking in getting in, and you don't know just where you're going to come out. But you just keep doing it, and something will come out of it, you think, and usually it does. So why don't we open it up?
I'm glad you mentioned the Rikers sale. The Rikers sale shows up in this book. If you haven't read the book, one of the nice things is recurring themes. So, of course, if you know Herb's life, you know people recur. So a lot of the same figures you meet early on at the early Vera show up in one guise or another in one project or another over the years. But But Rikers Island keeps showing up. This plan, I decided that that Sam and Herb must have decided they were going to use this book to keep that idea on the agenda, because almost every other chapter ends with a reminder that the Rikers Island project was his greatest regret, the best idea ever had. It keeps going. And I figured, I was sure you were going to tell us that the TARP program, TARP 2 or TARP 3, will allow the federal government to pay the state to buy Rikers Island, and finally we'll get that thing through. Ed Koch, when we did, Ellen and I and some others here, had a 35th anniversary party for Vera and honored Herb in the federal courthouse. Ed Koch came to that party. I had just taken over at Vera. And Ed Koch came up to me and said, "Well, Herbsters, you know, best, most brilliant planning commissioner, chairman we ever had. I don't think he really had a talent for criminal justice, but the planning stuff, that's really, he had this idea about selling Rikers Island to the state. I don't know, crazy. But the planning stuff, it was brilliant." So it just goes to show that idea stuck in one way or another with everybody. And I have no doubt that the state doesn't know it yet, but it's going to buy Rikers Island.